This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. It's not often that a debut novel reaches the number two position for hardback fiction in the New York Times bestseller list, but it's the achievement of Catherine Stockett, born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi. And who knows, her novel, The Help, may be number one next week. Set in the early 1960s in Jackson, The Help is about African-American maids showing up for work each day in white uniforms, cleaning and cooking for white families and raising their children, and forced to use separate facilities, often located in the garage. In the book, you'll read about the smart and selfless maids, Abilene and Minnie. We'll talk to Catherine Stockett this hour. Also, harnessing your creative powers to face obstacles at work and home, Jonathan Hall speaks to Robert Bluestone, who is in Iowa with his wife, Rebecca. They're the co-founders of Woven Harmony, and they say take ownership of your personal and professional creative resources in new, innovative ways. Talk of Iowa in 5 minutes following news. And this is Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese. We were hoping to connect to Catherine Stockett to discuss her book, The Help. We don't have her on the line yet. We hope to have her on the line with us here in just a couple of seconds, so stay with us for that. In the meantime, when Andrea St. John and Kevin Broderick met in 2006, they were both teaching high school in Lake Placid, New York. Kevin was in recovery from Ewing's sarcoma, a rare form of cancer that didn't stop them from falling in love. Broderick had been diagnosed with Ewing's sarcoma in 2004. Ewing's sarcoma typically occurs in the teenage years. It often strikes boys and is usually found in the bone. Recently, St. John spoke with Broderick's brother, Thomas, about the early days of their relationship.
I think it took a little while for him to build up the courage to ask me to do something alone. We had a lot of seventh grade style dates, you know, where a lot of our mutual friends kind of met in one
place.
Chaperones, yeah.
So you knew he had Ewing's?
Yeah.
Was that scary?
No, and not until when he went back for the checkup scans did I really think about cancer in his life or our lives. We were back at school when he got the call from his doctors, and being new to this, I walked into the faculty room and his eyes were red. And, you know, I hit go on the copier and I'm not paying attention. And then I turned around and said, "Are your eyes okay?" And then as soon as I got the words out of my mouth, I realized, oh no. And he said, "Yeah, I think you should get your jacket. Maybe we'll go for a walk." And he told me what his doctors had told him, that the cancer was back. There's a spot in my thigh and in my ribs and in my pelvis. And he paused, and he said, "The scans lit up like a Christmas tree." One morning, I woke up and got his tea ready and his breakfast ready and stuff and said, "Hey, I need your opinion on something. I want to wear this dress to your wake." And so I put it on, and I stood up on the bed, and I said, "How do I look?" And he started to cry. And I said, "Oh, God, I'm so sorry. I'll take it off. I didn't mean to upset you at all." And he said, "No, it's just that you look so beautiful. I'm so glad I got to see you in that dress." And he kept crying. And I held his hand and sat down on the bed next to him and said, "What's going on?" He said, "It's just that I woke up this morning more ready." And I asked him what that felt like. And he paused and looked at me and he said, "Well, I guess it's the same thing you felt when you put the dress on this morning."
It's 10 past 10. Now we go to Talk of Iowa here on Iowa Public Radio, and we now have connected with Catherine Stockett. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
It's really great to
talk.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, author of this wonderful book called The Help. An extraordinary book. Maybe it's already number one on the bestseller list of the New York Times. Haven't checked today. I don't think I've ever gotten absorbed so quickly and completely in the characters of a novel. It's set in a volatile time in the nation's history, the early 60s. The civil rights movement was firing up, and it was a dangerous time, especially for African Americans in the South. Your story is set in Jackson, Mississippi. It's mostly about black maids, and you have two especially strong and moving personalities and the characters of Abilene and Manny. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, they're very different people. Abilene is an older black woman who has been taking care of little white children, you know, for most of her life, and she's rather complacent, except something wakes up in her at the beginning of the book. And her best friend is named Minnie, and Minnie is a firecracker. You know, I like to say, if Minnie's thinking it, Minnie's saying it. She cannot control what comes out of her mouth, and consequently constantly gets fired from, you know, whatever white woman she's working for.
And you yourself had an African-American housekeeper and caregiver as a child growing up. Dimitri, is that how you say it?
Dimitri.
I'd like to ask you to tell us about Dimitri. What was her role in your family, and how did she influence you growing up?
She was amazing. She was so sweet and really around the kids, kind of private about her own life, but very involved in ours, and always called us, you know, she was the first person we spoke to on our birthdays. You know, she'd call us and wake us up before she even came to work. And she was, you know, gentle and funny and played all the parts that she was paid to play. But she didn't have any children of her own. So, you know, I believe, maybe naively so, that there was a greater connection there. Because when you ask her how many children she had, you know, it's unfathomable as a child when you meet a grown-up that has no children. And she used to say, you know, the three of you. So, you know, she wasn't the kind that talked back or complained. But when I turned about 30 years old, you know, for the first time in my life, I started wondering, gosh, what was she thinking all those years?
Yeah. And, of course, I'm sure that gave you the spark to write this book. What was she thinking? What were the other African-American maids thinking? They always wore white uniforms. Is that actually correct?
They did in our house, yeah, in all my friends' houses. Now it's not quite so formal. Mm. You know, they can wear whatever they want to.
Well, you say Dimitri had no children, but Abilene, you're one of the main characters, had a son who was killed in the novel. She was so loving to the daughter that she cared for in the White household, Mae Mobley, right? Her mother was so cold to the little girl, but Abilene was there for her with just lots of love. She's just an endearing character.
Yeah, I loved writing that relationship because, you know, as a child, you're just colorblind, and it's such a unique part of a person's life. And Mae Mobley, you know, is not the cutest baby in town to her mother's horror, and her mother's a social climber and is always trying to keep up with the Joneses, or in this case, Hilly Holbrook, who is the trendsetter, you know, president of the women's clubs, and leads the way for everyone and tells them what they should be wearing and thinking. And Elizabeth just wants to be like Hilly, even if it means, you know, ignoring her own child during the process.
Talking to Catherine Stockett, her book is called The Help. It's now number 2, hardback fiction, New York Times. She was raised in Jackson, Mississippi, attended school at the University of Alabama, now lives with her husband in Atlanta. We have listeners, I'm sure, Catherine, who would like to speak with you, and the toll-free number is 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. You'll be the guest of Prairie Light's independent bookseller on Sunday in Iowa City, reading, I believe, at 2 o'clock at the Iowa City Public Library. Let's go to...
Yes, I'm very excited to see your fair city. And I'm also very excited that this interview took place because the number that they gave me was Iowa Taco. So sorry I was late. It took me a few minutes to put this together.
You could have ordered some tacos while you were
talking. I know. Long
distance. We'll have to figure out what happened there. Let's go to Tori, who's calling from Urbana. Tori, good morning.
Good morning.
What's
Hello,
your question?
Catherine.
Yes. Hey.
Yes, I'm Dr. Charles Neal's son,
Oh, Tori, how are you? That's so funny. Dr. Neal grew up in Mississippi, and he was my grandfather's best friend. The book is dedicated to my grandfather because he was such an incredible storyteller. How are you?
I'm just fine. I'm looking forward to seeing you Sunday.
Well, thanks. I guess I've probably grown up a little since you saw me last. I was probably a very little girl.
I'm sure your grandfather and my father are sitting on a porch somewhere in heaven right now, swapping stories.
Sure they are, drinking coffee.
I can still remember playing in the hayloft in the barn and getting chewed out by your father or your grandfather for it.
Oh, yeah, he didn't put up with that.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to say hello and tell you that, again, that you hit the nail right on the head with your book. It's just a perfect reconstruction of that era and of the personalities, and I'm so glad that you've had this success. It's wonderful.
Well, I'm surprised, I have to say. It's been a wild ride, and I'm not sure what's driving it, but I don't know. Sometimes I'm ready to get off. But.
Yeah, I can. I bet it's been long, but I hear it just keeps going on and on and on. It just keeps selling. That's great. Anyway, I'll let somebody else talk to you, and I'm looking forward to seeing you Sunday.
Oh, that's great.
I'm so glad to hear from you. It's so nice that there's a Mississippian in Iowa.
Yeah.
Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
That's fabulous. Thanks so much, Tori, for the call. 866-780-9100. Iowa connection there with the book and with Catherine. Here's an email I want to get to from Judy in Cedar Rapids. My friends and I enjoyed the book, but we all have the same comment. The ending seemed rushed and lacked the depth of the and richness of the first 80% of the book. Our question is, did the publisher force you to shorten the book so the easiest thing to do was shave content from the latter part of the book, or did you run out of steam? And do you envision a sequel to the book?
I don't envision a sequel, and I wrote the ending 4 or 5 times. I certainly was not out of steam. I could have kept going. They didn't force me to do anything, but I'll tell you, I'm not a big Hollywood ending kind of writer, and I liked the idea of Abilene at the end of the story walking off into the sunshine, walking off essentially into 1965. The Civil Rights Act had just been passed, and I feel like if there had been a huge change at the end, it would have been misrepresenting that time, because as we know, as Americans, things don't happen overnight. Even if they change the laws in the courthouse, it takes years, sometimes decades, for things to actually change in our minds and in the homes. So thank you for reading it. I appreciate that, and thank you for sending in your email.
All right. Well, Catherine, hold on. We'll be back with you in a minute. Catherine Stockett, author of The Help, is on the line, and she'll be in Iowa on Sunday. 866-780-9100 to talk to Catherine. Talk of Iowa back in a minute. Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio, speaking with Catherine Stockett, who has a fabulous novel called The Help. It's being read all over the country, especially I'm hearing, Catherine, that book clubs are just grabbing this book up fast and enjoying it very, very much. I want to ask you about another character before we get to more calls. Her name is Skeeter Phelan. And you've done essentially what she did in telling this story. Granted, you're telling it outside the heat of the civil rights movement, as a fictional account, but you're telling it nonetheless. Do you identify with Skeeter?
A lot of people ask me that. They say, are you Skeeter? And as it happens to every author, from what I understand, they think that every character is the writer. But the truth is, I was never that brave, you know? Like, just as you said, to write about it, 50 years later, after the battle has died down, didn't take nearly as much nerve as Skeeter in the novel, who, you know, was right there on the battlefield with them. And, you know, and I use battlefield metaphorically because it's a whole different set of tools that women use as opposed to men. It's not the direct violence that most men, you know, use as their form of racism. Women are slightly more subtle, and we call it the shiny set of tools scene in the book, as I'm helping Tate Taylor. Every once in a while, he'll send me the next draft of the screenplay. The movie is set to film this summer in Mississippi. And we talk a lot about that shiny set of tools because it's hard to really define the subtle ways that women were racist, because they had to be careful how they spoke, but nonetheless they were clever and found ways to make sure that these women stayed in their station and did not advance economically. So I really enjoyed exploring that.
Let's go to a caller, Annie. Ann is calling from Mount Vernon. And good morning, Ann. You're on Talk of Iowa.
Hi. My sister gave me a book for my birthday last summer, and I loved it. And the character of Minnie made me laugh out loud. And it really made me think. But I was just curious. I read in Elle magazine that you were rejected 30 times from publishers. And how did you find Amy Einhorn, and how did you persevere through that process of getting published?
That must have been a misprint, because I wasn't turned down 30 times. I was turned down almost 60.
Oh, wow.
And that's where, yeah.
I might have misremembered, sorry.
Well, no, that's fine. They were actually agents. I never even had the nerve to send it to a publisher, and they really don't accept a lot of publishers' unsolicited manuscripts. I couldn't even get through that first gate for 3 years. And when I finally landed an agent, her name's Susan Raymer, I was so excited, and I thought, well, gosh, she must be taking this on as, like, you know, a small project. You know, maybe she's had a lot of other successes, so she could take a risk on this. And I thought, well, you know, it could take years to try to sell it to a publisher. But the time was right, I guess, and she sold it to Amy Einhorn, my publisher, in about a week. So if you're writing, I guess my recommendation is just keep trying. You really never know.
What is your next project?
I'll be, hopefully this summer, I'll really dig in. I've written about a third of it, a story about a group of women in Mississippi during the Great Depression. And these women have... all the men have left their lives. Either they've died, or they've run off, or they've divorced. And these women, you know, are having a very hard time getting by. So they come up with some clever ways to earn a living.
That sounds great. I will look forward to that. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anne, for the call from Mount Vernon. Are there still African-American maids taking care of white children in the South today?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
It's a booming business, but, you know, I can't really speak on behalf of the racial climate in Mississippi, really even in the South, because I've been in New York. We moved to Atlanta 2 years ago. And honestly, you know, I keep my head in the clouds. I'm a writer, and I'm more interested in the past than I am the present.
Yeah.
So I hope things are getting better. They must be.
Well, let's hope so. Let's go to Judy in Iowa City, who's calling in to Talk of Iowa. Good morning, Judy.
Actually, it's Julie, but good morning.
Good morning.
Catherine, hello. It's really nice to talk to you. I wanted to first tell you that my book club, we loved your book. We just loved it. But what I wanted to say that first so that my second comment wouldn't sound very harsh, but when I first started reading the book, because it was chosen by our book club, I kept looking at your bio and sort of the tone of the book, and I thought, honestly, this was what was in my head. What is this white girl doing writing about black people in the South? I thought, what would she know about it? And I actually felt a little offended on behalf of my black brothers and sisters. And then going into the book, there was such total credibility in the story, and I realized that here was a woman that was really speaking from experience and didn't have her, was colorblind, as you mentioned, children very often are colorblind. And I was just so pleased to go from that feeling of, how could she write about this when she's white, to, wow, she really knows this life and this era, and it just ended up being very touching and beautiful to me. So I wanted to thank you for the book and just also ask you if you ever get that reaction from people, and I'll just take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Julie.
Yeah, thanks, Julie.
The truth is, I still feel that terrifying feeling, it has to be because that's the way I was raised, you know? I was raised, we didn't talk about race. It was tacky. It was unladylike. So when I first crossed that line, I only had the nerve to write in the voice of a Black person because I didn't think anybody was going to read it. So, you know, I wrote with a real abandon that had I known, I don't know what I know now, I don't know that I would have written it with such freedom. But yes, I completely understand your misgivings of why a white girl would write in a Black voice. And let me tell you, I can't say this enough, and I even printed it in the back of the book. I don't presume to think that I know what it really felt like to be a Black made woman in the 60s. That said, I feel like as a writer, it is my job to explore and try to make the reader understand as best I can what it feels like to be in someone else's shoes. So thank you for your honesty.
You know, maybe it was my favorite character in the book, one of the maids. She was such a character and so outspoken. But you know, she had to go home in the book and raise her own kids. And I'm thinking, how did these maids do it if they had five or six kids at home? They take care of white kids all day and do the cleaning, and incredible amount of labor, laundry, cleaning. I mean, scrubbing silver, and they have to go home and cook for their own family. It must have been just impossible. It must have been exhausting, wasn't it?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Therein lies the irony, because you're right. They leave their own children to take care of someone else's. And that still is the way it is today. We go to work, and some of us have to send our kids to daycare or have them looked after by a family member. It's the economic cycle.
How long did you spend doing actual research on this book, Catherine?
Well, the research just never ended. I was constantly learning things. People would, it's not always the easiest conversation to start up with a Black person in the South. You know, oh, were you a maid? What was that like? You know, immediately everything tenses up in them. So I had to find more subtle, genteel ways to approach the subject. But I just kept my ears open, I guess, and tried to listen to what people were telling me between the lines. Sometimes they'd be smiling and say, oh, yeah, I love my job. But you could tell.
Well, I wish
story.
I wish we had more time, but I know you're on a book tour, and the good news is you'll be in Iowa this weekend, and again, Iowans have a chance to hear Catherine and see Catherine Stockett read at the Iowa City Public Library, 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon. We'll look forward to that. Thank you so very, very much. Good luck with all your future writing, Catherine.
Thank you, Dennis.
Talk of Iowa continues. Robert Bluestone on Creativity in 5 minutes.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's been well documented that healing isn't just about medicine and science. There's many other elements that can add to someone's healing, all related to their state of mind and state of well-being. There's a duo in residency in the state of Iowa for this 3-week period that speaks to that message with music and art. They're the Bluestones, and Robert Bluestone is joining us. He's our guest in this half hour of the show. Robert, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Oh, Jonathan, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, you're a musician. Rebecca, who couldn't join us this morning, is an artist who works in tapestry. Tell us a little bit about what you guys do.
Good question. on the surface, it would seem that a loom and a classical guitar don't have much in common. But when you think about it, a loom is a handmade wooden instrument. Guitar is a handmade wooden instrument. Loom is tightly strung. So is a guitar. The loom is manipulated by fingers, as is the guitar. But most importantly, my wife, as you can see from, well, you folks can't see it out there, but if you come tomorrow night to our performance at the incredible art museum that you have here, you'll be able to see her work. She is a master of color. And it's amazing what she can do in terms of the infinite palette of color that she has.
Describe what you two do with those mediums to kind of project this message and this concept that you're trying to share with people.
Well, it's an interesting thing. A very wise woman named Jeanetta Cole said that art is the expression of the experience of being human. There are no other collaborations between a fiber artist and a guitarist. So we saw these connections, these aesthetic connections to what we do, and we also had this idea of how could we get folks in communities to understand that creativity is not just the province of artists. Creativity is within us all. And how could we spread that word?
And how do you relate that to healing? Because a lot of the work that you do and some of the work that you're doing while you're here in Iowa is related to taking that creative element and applying it to the concept of healing.
Well, healing related to us first. In 2001, Rebecca was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. That was, in Spanish, we call it a choque. It was a real shot. It was a hard thing for me to handle the idea that my wife was sick and there was nothing I could do. But we were very fortunate because it was stage one. It wasn't stage three. Stage three survival rates haven't changed in 35 years for ovarian cancer. So Rebecca went through this very major surgery, and then she went through 6 months of chemotherapy. And at that point, it was really interesting because we decided that we had learned some hard-won wisdom from this experience that we went through from the inside, and we could take that into the healthcare community. So we started working with cancer survivor groups, cancer support groups, but then we quickly realized that what we had learned was very applicable to anyone who was going through a major illness in a hospital. And then it spread from there because we realized Rebecca had helped her mother die of breast cancer that metastasized, and I was Rebecca's caretaker. And we started looking at doctors and nurses and staff, and we realized that the caretakers in hospitals were not taking very good care of themselves. So we started working with caretakers on, okay, what are you doing to take care of yourself? And for me, it's always been something to work with husbands of women who are going through it, because a lot of times that sense of helplessness, that sense of rage that I felt, they feel that. So I can help them. I can talk to them. I can say, okay, there are things you can do that are very proactive in terms of making your wife feel better, building this kind of protective wall around her, making sure that she gets good care. And the word got around. So we started doing this all over the country, and we were invited to the Mayo in Rochester, Minnesota, to do a keynote there and then a week residency there. And we got to work at the superb Holden Cancer Center here for a week a couple of years ago. And this idea was hatched at that time, kind of coming out of that time, especially since Hancher doesn't exist right now as a building, to partner between, or among, I should say, Hancher Auditorium, the Holden Cancer Center, and the School of Public Health there, and partner in each community with some of these superb facilities that are here. You've got the Stoddard Cancer Center, our main partner here with Iowa Radiology. It's a great facility. The staff is wonderful. The care that people are getting there is first rate. We got to work with patients yesterday. We got to work with staff. We did on Monday night something that we really love to do. This is the time of year. It's a little bit later, but because we're here now, we did a Cancer Survivors Day celebration, which is a great thing to do.
Earlier you said that you wanted to take what you've learned and pass it on. What did you learn?
I've learned a lot of things from this. Number one, the fragility of life. We never know from moment to moment what life has for us. The Greeks said we never know what destiny has in store for us. Number two, be able to go into situations and be able to help people through the music, through talking with people. When it doesn't matter that I played in Carnegie Hall and I've toured all over the world. All of that stuff is ego stuff. When I go into a hospital, the idea is I check my ego at the door, and whatever the situation demands, whatever the situation needs, that's what I bring to the table. Or to the bedside. For example, if I'm in an infusion suite, people are getting chemotherapy. Do they want me to play for them? Do they want to talk? What do they want? What do they need? What does that situation demand? And I love doing that kind of work because you really have to read the room. And it's not easy, but it's so rewarding to be able to do it. Rebecca would say she was glad that she got sick because she's learned so much from that. I actually wish it was me who got sick instead of her. That would have been better. But
why?
Because then it could have been seeing my wife suffer the way she did, being sick, and knowing that I, beyond comfort, beyond caretaking, that was probably the hardest part for me. I would have rather the pain was on my shoulders rather than her shoulders.
But if it's harder to be the caretaker watching somebody you love go through that, if you were going through it, wouldn't that have made it harder on Rebecca because she would have been the one whose loved one would have been going through it?
You postulate a good idea, but the truth of the matter is that Rebecca's a lot stronger than I am. Women are stronger than men, and Rebecca is made of sterner stuff, as Shakespeare says.
When someone faces an illness, either themselves or somebody that they love, there's a self-realization process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's possible to get somebody that level of understanding and self-realization without having gone through it? Because at some level, we all feel like we're invincible, and I can listen to your story and be moved by it at some level, but the next day I kind of go on with my life, and it isn't until something catastrophic happens to me or somebody that I love that I really internalize the message.
There's an Iowa story I can tell you about that.
Please do.
I have a very close friend who actually runs the International Writers Program at the University of Iowa, a fellow named Chris Merrill.
A guest on this show more than once.
A superb, superb individual.
Mm-hmm.
Chris lived in Santa Fe, and his editor is a fellow named Robert Chebb. And Robert came home from a trip abroad, wasn't feeling too well, went to a doctor, and the doctor did some blood work and found out that Robert had acute monoblastic leukemia. He said to him, "You're going to die in 2 months." And in fact, he died exactly 2 months later. The people he wanted around to help him were myself, Chris, and my wife, Rebecca. And so we got Robert home, situated with his wife, and we were the close-in group there. And the word taboo actually means infused with the sacred. In an American culture, sex isn't a taboo, violence isn't a taboo, but what is a taboo is death. people think that death is the opposite of life, but it isn't. Death is the opposite of birth. And it's all part of living. And we learned this wonderful lesson from Robert Jett, because he had, as Robert Johnson said, hellhounds on his trail. And he let go of all of those things, and he died really well.
But you lived that experience, though.
Yes.
You had a proximity to that most of us don't. So if someone goes to your presentation, and again, even if they're completely moved by the stories that you have and the art that you show and the music that you perform, I'm speculating that you can get to one layer of understanding with that, and it may better prepare you from where your inevitable exposure to this is, be it you or a loved one.
Mm-hmm.
But you never really get it until you have that proximity to it that you're describing.
I think there's a truth to what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that one of the things that we try to do, and it's a larger message than just for healthcare, is this idea that we can be creative in the moment, that everyone has within them this creativity, which they can look at their life at any given time and decide, is this going to be a positive moment? Is this going to be a negative moment? And we've had so many folks come up to us after our presentations and say, thank you. You opened up a door for us, for me, so I could look at my life in a different way.
It sounds like you're talking about a level of consciousness that some people find through religion, some through spirituality.
Yes.
That you believe this can be a pathway to get there.
Yes, I do. The thing about art is a very interesting thing. If you think about it linguistically, philologically, where you can go with it is that it gets to the interstices, the spaces between the words, and you can say things with art that you simply can't say any other way. And that opens people up to new experiences.
What about the interpretation? Because any artist can present something in a certain way, but everybody's individual interpretation is going to be different. And when you talk about those, the pieces between, and really the high level of intricacy that some piece of art can be consumed, that's going to be 10 different interpretations for 10 different people. Do you think it still has a commonality even with that wide spectrum of different interpretation?
I think the commonality is that everybody has their own interpretation. That's what makes us unique, all of us.
Let's talk about some of your music. The Woven Harmony Suite is who was the composer of this music?
Oh, a fellow named Andrew York.
And he knew you and was aware that this would be something that would be performed on classical guitar with a tapestry shown that would be informed by the music?
Well, we were still... This is where we got creative, because William Faulkner wrote a trilogy about the South, the Snopes Family Trilogy. He wrote the first two volumes, and then 25 years later, he wrote the final volume. And in the introduction, he said, if you detect changes between this volume and the two that preceded it, he said, I make no apologies. He said, life is growth. Stasis is death. Simply put, I chose to live. So for us, our collaboration has had to grow. It must grow. We just can't. If you keep doing the same thing, you're mailing it in, and we don't want to do that. So we realized that we had to find the right composer to write something at us. So we brought Andy out from L.A. And you don't know the name Andrew York, but you know the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet.
Mm-hmm.
He played for a very long time in the L.A. Guitar Quartet. He's a terrific guitarist, a wonderful composer, and he's a close friend. He's a great guy. And so he came out. He spent time in my studio with me listening to how I play. He spent time with Rebecca observing the process of weaving.
Mm-hmm.
And he got to understand what our collaboration was about. And then he wrote this piece at us.
So, and Rebecca did the tapestry after?
Yes. I learned the music, mm-hmm. and she listened to it, and she interpreted each of the six movements.
Let's listen to a little bit of the first movement. It's called Squares Suspended. Thank you. what was your interpretation of that, and what's your take on how Rebecca interpreted this movement?
Rebecca loves to use squares in her work. She's used them for a long time in her work. And the square, Carl Jung talked about the square as being this shape that's got this solidity to it. And Andy did the introduction to this. You hear these four little phrases that constitute the introduction. And then there's a lot of the phrases within it that are in fours, little groups of four notes. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful, tranquil piece. And there's a very funny story about this. We were doing a keynote for the National Governors Association in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And I played this, and the wife of the governor of Wyoming came up to Rebecca afterwards and said, you know, that was so beautiful. It moved me to tears, that piece. And so I had to call Andy afterwards. I said, you know, Andy, the wife of the governor, it's good news, loved this piece of music. And it moved her to tears. He said, well, is there bad news? I said, well, there's a warrant out for your arrest in Wyoming. So don't plan on touring there anytime soon. So that movement is a lovely movement. He really hit it out of the – in fact, with the whole suite, he hit it out of the park.
Let's listen to some of the final movement. It's called Woven World.
It's great, that movement, because when we asked Andy about it, he said, oh, it's life, the universe, and everything. He said, that's what it's about for him, our work, the ups and downs, the joys of life. And the progression in it is kind of a rock and roll progression. It's like a 1-4-5 progression that you'd run into in rock and roll.
There's no limit to what you can do on a guitar, but it is six strings.
Yeah.
And there's some – I'm just trying to think how daunting it is to try to talk about life, the universe, and everything in a movement of a suite. That sounds like a daunting task. How did you approach that as an artist?
In a joyful way, because I think that what he was trying to do was to celebrate life, celebrate the ups, celebrate the downs. He very well understood about what Rebecca had gone through in terms of her dealing with cancer and this work that she does. So it really makes sense. And it starts beautifully and ends very quietly. It's really nice.
You've already been to Spencer and Algona. You're in Des Moines right now. You'll be in Grinnell, Davenport, and Iowa City during the 3-week residency. And you mentioned earlier that you saw all these locations back in February.
Mm-hmm.
And you've traveled all over the country. What strikes you about Iowa? Because you do these kinds of things in so many different places.
Yes.
What strikes you about Iowa?
Well, if I had to pick a heart of Iowa, it would be what was Hancher Auditorium, which will evolve into this new thing now. Mm-hmm. There's a heartbeat there because Hancher at the University of Iowa reaches out across the state and it encompasses all of these communities. And maybe it's the severity of the winters. Maybe it's I'm not sure what it is. It's something that I am delighted with. We'd go into these communities and we'd meet with these committees of people who were so excited about this project, who were so engaged, who were so positive. For me, what I'm seeing, and Iowa really represents it, is I'm seeing there's a new thing happening in the United States right now. I'd say it's a new level of maturity What we're seeing, especially in Iowa, in all of the communities, I was struck by people how across, it wasn't about politics. It was about we're here, we're in this together. It's a community state. There's something quite wonderful here. This is a field of dreams. This really is something special.
Robert, thank you so much for coming. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
That's all the time we have today for Talk of Iowa. The first half of our program was hosted and produced by Dennis Reese. This half was produced by John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about the program. You can contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us.